Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Invested. I'm Danielle Towne. We're off again this week. You can hear I'm super stuffed up. We decided not to subject you to listening to this voice for a whole episode. So what we're going to do is put up one from way, 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 way back. I think you're going to enjoy it. You're going to hear how different my attitude and knowledge about investing is. And I hope that it will make you think a little bit about how your investing practice got started and where you were when you first started. So enjoy. Have a great week. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Hi, everybody. This is Phil Towne.
And this is Danielle Towne.
We're here for the Invested podcast, where we talk about investing in businesses, also known as stocks.
We talk about buying the whole business, or acting as if you buy the whole business.
Exactly.
When you buy one share of stock.
Yeah, and we've been talking lately about the basic idea that Warren Buffett has. We're very big on Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger type investing. And we've been talking about how to value something in the way Buffett looks at, say, a piece of real estate or a farming operation and just values them as a business is exactly the same way that we want to value any business, whether it's public or private. We want to pay a certain price for it, and we want to understand what we're buying. And we started off this podcast a long time ago with Charlie Munger telling us these four simple things. And it would probably be a good idea, what do you think, just to repeat them really quickly right here.
I love the four principles. I think about them all the time now. They're so simple, and yet there's so much to say about them. I mean, we spent, I think, six podcasts maybe when we first started talking about four principles. And I almost think we should do another six now that we're like 40 podcasts down the road.
Yeah, and we've got a lot of
just to go through them.
We've got a lot of sort of water under the bridge or a little more experience in talking about the overall ideas of investing. And there's no question that Charlie is, at one time saying that the reason they don't teach these simple principles in the university is because there wouldn't be anything for the professor to talk about the rest of the semester, which is not really the case.
Now, who's Charlie again? Will you just tell us who Charlie Munger is?
Okay, Charlie Munger is a guy that grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, and is considered by many people to be maybe the only guy ever to come out of Omaha, Nebraska who is actually smarter than Warren Buffett. And they became friends in the late 1950s and have been partners in investing ever since. They don't always invest in the same things. But
they don't. I was wondering if he was like technically an officer of Berkshire Hathaway or what his professional role is related to Warren Buffett.
Well, you'll have to tell me as an attorney whether the vice chairman of the board is an officer.
Oh, no, he's not an officer.
Okay, so he's the vice chairman of the board of Berkshire Hathaway. And more importantly, he's been Warren's concept guy for how to invest. It's really kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Buffett gives Ben Graham full credit, full marks for teaching him how to invest. And Ben Graham, of course, is the author of Security Analysis and the Intelligent Investor, both of which were kind of seminal works in the idea of value investing. That is that companies have value in the marketplace, and sometimes the market doesn't put the price properly where the value is. Sometimes it's priced way higher than the value and when the market's irrationally exuberant, and sometimes the price is too low when the market's really depressed. And Ben Graham fathered those ideas and gave them legitimacy by putting numbers to it all in security analysis. And then he taught Buffett. But Graham's style and many value investors' style is to buy a lot of stocks. Graham would buy like 200 stocks. And he would just hope that he was buying a basket full of companies, many of which would survive and some of which would go broke, and then he would come out okay. And that worked really, really well during the Depression and World War II. But by the middle 1950s, early 1960s, there weren't as many companies around at the price that you could buy companies at the Depression.
So he was only choosing companies that were undervalued, but then he would just buy all the ones he found that were undervalued?
Yeah, more or less.
It's and like, not really look at the fundamentals of the actual company? Is that what you mean?
Exactly. He wouldn't worry about the fundamentals of the company so much, just understanding basically that the company was messed up or it wouldn't have been on sale. So yeah. He wouldn't worry about the fundamentals so much, although he certainly paid attention to them. Let me back off of that a minute. The security analysis is all about that.
200 different companies, that's a lot.
Yeah, so you're just running off a few basic numbers and buying a hugely diversified portfolio on, and consider though, the price he was paying was less than net working capital, which means that, you know, if you sold the whole company off, you would have bought it cheaper than what you'd have in your hand for cash. Hmm. So, you know, that's Depression era stuff.
Yeah. You know.
You're not going to find
So he was basically hoping that more than not would go. Wait, no. What am I trying to say? Part of them would go bankrupt. Part of them would do well. Part of them would sort of stay the same. I imagine that's what he was expecting.
That's right. And Buffett used to characterize this by calling it cigar butt investing. Because, you know, back in the Depression, people would, you know, a rich guy would walk down the street and throw away his cigar before it was completely gone, right? And guys would pick it up out of the off the street with a few puffs still in it, but it was free. And so Buffett said, that's essentially what my teacher was trying to do, is to just get companies that are basically free. And some of them would still have some puffs left in them.
Yeah, but you weren't sure until you picked it up and gnawed on a little nasty thing,
yeah, what it was like. So Charlie comes along after Buffett had been doing this for a few years in the late 1950s. Charlie comes along and says, look, this is the classic Charlie Munger quote. Warren, it's better to buy a wonderful business for a fair price than to buy a fair business for a wonderful price. Mm-hmm. So the point being that wonderful businesses are going to keep being wonderful for a long, long time. And so even if you goof up and don't get it for a super, super discount, you still got a really good company. Whereas if you pay a little too much for a relatively weak business, you can get hammered. So you got to get it right. It's easier to get it right going for wonderful businesses. That was Charlie's big sort of contribution to the whole concept of investing. And Buffett Partnerships and then Berkshire Hathaway starting in 1969 benefited from that. And it's historical, right? I mean, these guys have compounded money at over 20% a year for 50 or 60 years. It's stunning. In other words, $10,000 invested back then when they figured this out today is worth about $40 million.
Gosh.
Yeah, it's huge what compounding does. So that concept of wonderful business is now really key to Buffett. And that's what Charlie's talking about. And that takes a lot of unwinding. It's like, first, you have to be capable of understanding that it is a wonderful business. Second, it's only going to be wonderful if it has some kind of intrinsic characteristic that protects it from competition, which Warren Buffett calls a moat. And then third, you got to have good management in there. You got to have people who are good at what they do and can.
We would like to have good management.
True.
Well, but it's not a requirement.
It's not a requirement because if the business is really wonderful, it can survive past bad management.
Yeah, which scares me a little bit, I will say. I'm not sure. Like, my instinct is towards the gotta have good management.
I think that's a good instinct, tell you the truth. I think that's really wise. It's just that it's nice that the whole system doesn't hang on having to have great management. When you do venture
capital, it's really hard to know about people.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Venture capitalists are looking as much at the jockey as the horse. Like they really bank on having people that they believe in who will figure it out.
They tend to bet much more on the jockey than on the horse because the horse tends to change.
Well, this is your expertise. I mean, you're a lawyer in that field, and so the horse tends to change. Well, when you're investing your hard-earned retirement money, it's not gambling money. Like those venture guys are gambling.
Well, they wouldn't say that.
Okay, fair enough. Would they actually say that they really seriously know they're going to make money?
No, I mean the classic venture portfolio is, let's say you have 10 companies, you expect 3 of them to completely die and go bust, 3 of them to go nowhere, 3 that do pretty well, like maybe you make some money, and one that kills it. So if you have that, you make money as a venture capitalist.
Very cool. So 30%. Oh, and by the way, the long-term rate of return for venture capitalists that are successful runs only slightly higher than Buffett's long-range rate of return as well. I don't know if you knew that, but they run about 26%, you know, a double every 3 years kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Most of those guys would be pretty excited about that. And if you think about it, they're basically saying that we're going to have 30% of our companies are going to lose every penny we put in them. 30%, we're just going to get our money back. And then what?
30%, you hope, like do pretty well. You know, maybe they get sold. Maybe they make a little bit of money. Everybody kind of goes home pretty happy.
Yeah.
But it's nothing crazy.
Nothing crazy.
And then you hope you get one that's Facebook or Uber or, you know, whatever the new hot thing is that just goes nuts in IPOs.
Sure. So let's say you put $1,000 in each of these 10
investments. Let me just say, you hope that all of them do that.
Yeah,
But that's the classic sort of what you would expect from a decent VC portfolio.
Right. So venture capitalists, they don't come in and go, well, you know, these 3 out of 10 are probably really suck investments, but we're going to do them anyway.
No, they expect them all to do well.
Yeah,
but the thing with startups is that there's so much changing with tech startups, high growth tech startups. There's so much changing so quickly in that field, and people's ideas change all the time. And there's like the classic, like you say, you know, the company pivots, which always makes me think of Ross on Friends yelling pivot about the couch. But it's like that. It's like you pivot the company, and the idea that you start with often is not the idea that ends up going to market. But the people do stay the same. So that's why they look at betting on the jockey instead of the horse.
And this is the vast difference between investing in my view and speculation. With investing, there shouldn't be a pivot. With investing, you should have a business that's so simple that an idiot can run it, but it's locked in with this intrinsic protection, this moat, such that it's very hard to compete with these guys. So you want simple, but you want moat. And, you know, I got to tell you, those are not that easy to come by.
No. I mean, I do think that VC investing is not speculation. There's an awful lot of deals that those guys see that they say no to. And it's really more of a skill than choosing the right company is saying no to the wrong company.
Let's clarify.
But it's very different from the kind of investing that you look at, which is established companies that have a track record. When you're looking at companies that have absolutely zero track record, the only thing you really can go on are the people and the idea that those people have come up with, as well as their plan to go forward. But you don't have any backward looking data to rely on.
Well, I'm going to argue back here. I'm going to push back that unless you're, in other words, investing is something that has a high degree of certainty to it. I'm going to make the bar really high in terms of certainty. It's not perfect certainty. So we'll say, the most perfect certainty you can get in an investment is to invest in a U.S. government treasury bond, because the U.S. government is not going to go broke. And now the reason I don't say that's perfect certainty is because there's never been a country in the history of the world that hasn't eventually destroyed its currency. Eventually, they print too much of it and it crashes it, and you end up owning something that gets devalued 10 to 1. So even in when they have a printing press, you don't have perfect certainty. But we're going to say that that's as close as it gets in the real world to certainty, because the government is going to pay you 2% every year for 10 years. Deal.
Okay. Fair enough.
That's certainty. All right. Then we come down to the next level of certainty, which is sort of Warren Buffett-ish, what we would call Rule 1 investing, where you're buying a company which has characteristics of a bond with the U.S. government. That is that there's a high degree of likelihood that this cash flow is going to continue for as long as you intend to be in the investment. That's the in my view, the highest level of certainty you can get while investing in a company. Okay? Then you step down another level. And when you step down another level, you shift. I'm going to call those things investing. I'm going to say that when you buy with a great degree of certainty that the cash flow is going to continue, you've almost bought a bond. In fact, Buffett calls these things equity bonds. So to him, Coca-Cola, American Express, IBM, Wells Fargo, these are bonds. They're not stocks in the traditional sense, that they just can go up and down and your return goes up and down with them. All of these companies pour cash out to Warren Buffett's ownership. And they would do yours too if you owned them. So these are cash cows. They're cash machines. And they're producing all this cash like a bond. So they have that in common with a bond. Now, unlike a bond, there is some degree of speculation. In other words, they're not the federal government and they don't have a printing press. But think
they're
about
definitely
it.
Not, they are private companies. Yes, they are not the federal government. They're private companies that can go bankrupt. Yes, they have a long track record and a very good high probability that they'll continue doing well. But they're private companies. I mean,
they
I
are.
Very much dislike this comparison to a government bond.
Ah, well, let me further my case.
Please.
Each of these companies produces a bond.
A dividend.
No. A bond. They actually issue corporate bonds. So, for example, if you go to the bank and you buy a CD, in effect, you're buying a corporate bond of some sort, right? They package them together and they give you a CD, or you buy one corporation's bond. So Coca-Cola issues debt, and the debt is called a bond. And you buy this Coca-Cola bond, and Coca-Cola guarantees it'll pay you with all of the net assets of the corporation behind it, which is one step more secure than stock, which doesn't have the assets of the corporation behind it.
Right.
But a Coca-Cola bond is only slightly, you know, more secure than the stock itself.
Well, I feel like that's a big thing to say. Bondholders get paid before stockholders.
True.
So I would say it is strongly more secure than owning stock.
Well, here's the catch. Coca-Cola doesn't have a huge amount of sort of General Motors-like assets, right? It doesn't have plants everywhere. It doesn't have, they're not car machinery. They don't have acres of land. You know, I mean, they have acres of land, but they don't have millions of acres. They don't have a lot of hard assets. So Coca-Cola's value is really wrapped up in its actual business operations. If those business operations were to shut down so that shareholders didn't get any money, I would argue pretty strongly that the Coca-Cola brand is kaput and the value of the bonds would be crushed and you probably wouldn't get your money back entirely. Might get some of it back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So yeah, they're a little bit there. That's why I'm saying the distinction between owning Warren Buffett's equity bond, that is the stock of Coca-Cola, versus owning Coca-Cola's actual corporate bond is a matter of degree, but it's not a huge matter of degree. I mean, and I'll grant you 100% the U.S. government is much more secure. Okay. But we're talking a matter of degree. So we come U.S. government, then we come, let's say, Wells Fargo, the best bank operation in the United States. They issue a bond and now you own the Wells Fargo bond. The only problem is you're only going to get like 4% from the Wells Fargo bond. If you own the Wells Fargo stock, you get a 2% dividend plus the growth of the company, which is growing at 4 or 5% a year, which is 6 or 7% versus the corporate bond.
Okay. I think you're trying to say that owning certain sort of, I don't know if those are, Coca-Cola I think is a blue chip stock, but I don't know if Wells Fargo is.
Yeah.
But blue chip style stocks are very secure.
They're
is that
very
what you're
secure.
Trying to say?
Yeah, they're very
okay.
Secure. So I'm going down a sort of a ladder of risk. And at some point down this ladder, it's no longer an investment. It becomes a speculation. So my argument is that U.S. government, we'll just say that's no speculation. Then we're going to say, okay, then corporate bonds, some speculation, but not a lot if it's blue chips. And then equity bonds, which were own the stock of a blue chip. And then you get down below that into normal stocks, which you could own as an equity bond. And then you get down below that and below that and below that. And somewhere down that ladder, way down the ladder, are your venture capitalists.
Oh, absolutely. It's so risky. I mean, I'm not saying at all that it's not risky.
Good.
I'm saying the people who do it and make money at it still are good at it and believe that they are investing, not speculating, and are making discerning choices so that they invest rather than speculate. But regardless, it's very risky. Angel investors are very risky with their money. Like, it's a very risky thing to do.
So
anything different than that?
I think I just caught that your definition of investing is that you said something about you know a lot about the company or something like that. What was it you said?
I said there's a level of discernment
in
what they choose to put their money in.
Okay, so now let's go over to horse racing for a second. Horse racing would not be considered investing, right?
Well, I suppose it depends on how much you know about the horses. Well,
I'm going to assume you know a lot about the horses. You're like studying the horses and you have a lot of knowledge. You have all the knowledge you can have about horse racing. Investing or speculating?
Do I have all the knowledge I can have about those horses actually in the given race?
Yeah, like everything you could know,
I know everything.
Well, you're not God, but you know everything that the trainers know about those horses. Yeah.
I would say that's investing.
Ooh, you would?
I would, because you know what horses are more likely to win than other horses with a pretty strong degree of certainty. Now, there's probably like two or three who could all win. And in that, that's where you just have to, you know, hopefully use your knowledge, since you know almost everything except for what God knows about, like, the amount of sleep they got the night before and what they ate and that kind of thing.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with you in general, because there are very good syndicates that put lots of people's money together who study the horses really closely and historically, I know one of them did $150 million in profit. So they did it really consistently too.
That's completely insane.
It is crazy, but I still would not call that investing. I think there's a high degree of...
Well, but you're conflating risky investing and speculation. You're using the term speculation to mean risky investing.
Yes,
right?
Which means there's no such thing as risky investing in my definition. Those things are not the same thing.
You're using investing to mean low risk investing.
Yeah. So risky investing is an oxymoron.
No.
Yes, it is. It's an oxymoron. It's just a bunch of people that don't want to admit that they're actually rolling the dice. They just don't want to admit it. And it's in their interest not to admit that they're actually speculators. If you're a venture capitalist and trying to raise money from pension funds, you don't want to go in and say, hey, we're a speculator, man.
Because they're not speculating. They have reasons for doing what they're doing.
But
I think of speculating as just, as you just said literally 15 seconds ago, rolling the dice. There is no rhyme or reason to what numbers are going to come up on that dice when you roll it, and that's the whole point.
Whereas, oh my gosh, you are so uninformed about dice.
I am not uninformed about dice.
There's a complete rhyme or reason to what numbers are going to come
up. Stop it. Don't say things like that.
There is. Okay, clearly you have never played craps.
No, I've never played craps.
That's right. Because if you had, you would know that on the crap table, if you get a number, like let's say 8, that there are very specific odds of the 8 coming up that are different than all the rest of the numbers on those dice. In other words, you're rolling 2 dice. So there's a set of odds that are saying that the odds of getting these numbers are much, much higher. Because, for example, in order to get a 2, there's only one way you can get a 1 and a 1.
Now you're talking about something different.
I'm talking about probability.
You're talking about combination of dice. And what I was talking about was one die being thrown.
I didn't say
and
we're
to
rolling.
My knowledge,
no.
To my knowledge,
no.
Unless it's a weighted die, there is an equal probability of any of those 6 numbers coming up.
Roll back the tape and you'll hear that I said roll of the dice. Not roll of the die, it's roll of the dice. And that is, in fact, full of math about what's going to come up next.
That is true.
The probability
of combinations of numbers.
Yep.
That is true. There are various, you know,
yes. So,
statistics about that.
Roll of the dice.
And you know perfectly well that's not what I meant when I was talking.
I don't. What I think is that you're trying to make the case that risky investing is actually meaningful. What I'm saying is it's a contradiction of terms and an oxymoron. And what you've got is a situation where the dice have odds, but you're gambling. That's what gambling is. And so it's not that gambling is just you're an idiot throwing one dice and they all have exactly the same odds of coming up. One die. Let us not confuse it. And it's not like a matter of odds. Like Warren Buffett's not going to go into a company where the odds are good. It's going to come out all right. That's completely anathema to investing. I don't invest when it's an odds bet. Even, you know, okay, there's a 70% chance it's going to come out right.
No, there's no way that's true. There's always some chance it won't come out right.
Yeah, but as soon as you start to be able to put any kind of odds on it, you've stepped into the world of speculation. Like Buffett used to do, and maybe still does, a lot of merger acquisition betting. He was very clear. It's speculation. We've got these two companies that are merging. The odds on this happening, the probability of it happening is like 90%. Okay, great. Now we can run an analysis that says, you know, if we put in this much money and, you know, and that's what we could lose, and here's how much we could win, and we've got a 90% probability, we can figure out whether we ought to make that bet. But that's not the case for, you know, putting money in Wells Fargo. There's nothing that says, oh, yeah, it's about 95% probability that Wells Fargo will be around in 10 years. No.
No, I don't. Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a 99%
point nine. I would say if the country's around in 10 years, you know, 99.9999, Wells Fargo is too.
The part we don't know is whether Wells Fargo's stock price is going to be up in 10 years. That's the part we don't know.
And here's the beauty, Danielle. Investing like Buffett does it and investing like I do it, we really don't care. We don't care. We don't care what the market's doing. And this is really critical to understanding really the difference between investing and speculating. So I think you've opened a fabulous sort of area that we really have to concentrate on. I was going to talk more about Chipotle, Mexican Grill's valuation and all that. We'll do that next time. Let's finish this. This is hugely important.
Okay. If we're going to talk about something besides Chipotle, we have to take a minor interlude and just say, we meant to talk about Chipotle. We meant to talk about Chipotle last week, but we had the worst technical difficulties we've ever had. And last week was just, we got cut off and it was just a mess. Yeah. And now this week we're totally off on some different topics. So I'm fine pushing Chipotle to next week, but just so everybody knows that we're pushing it.
I wanted to talk about, you know, Chipotle badly, but we keep getting into these issues that I think are more important to correct. And I, you know, I really want you to understand that there is a gap that exists between investing and speculating, and that people who say they are investing, and there's many of them, are not investing. They're just speculators. And that includes the people who run your mutual funds, who run the pension funds, anybody that's investing in an index, they're all speculators.
And so you seem to have a very clear idea in your mind of what speculation is versus investing.
Well, I certainly have a sense of what kind of product it is that I would call it speculating versus the kind of product I'd call investing. So, I mean, I just named a couple of things that virtually 99% of the people who are managing other people's money would say are investments. And I just call them speculation.
Okay, say those again.
Okay, your mutual funds and the indexes, the stock market indexes, are speculative. And the reason that they're speculative is you're basically buying into something, expecting it to go up because it's gone up in the past. That's your only reason. Like, okay, I think America's going to be better in the future than it was in the past. Well, we're right now in the first generation of people. You are likely to have, as an average in your generation, a less wealthy life than me. First generation in the history of America. In other words,
I have all sorts of reasons that I think the market is going to go up. Does that make me an investor or am I still a speculator?
I think you're a speculator.
Simply because I'm buying an index. Well, so it has nothing to do with my own preparation or reasons for making a certain purchase.
It does. It's just that the world of things that you have to know that America is going to be fabulous down the road in 20 years, which means the stock market has doubled three more times in that period of time, if it keeps up with historical averages, you have to know a lot of stuff. You have to know that you'd have to make an analysis and say that, well, if regulation keeps compounding on American business at its previous rate of growth, it won't choke off American businesses totally. Second, you'd have to say that if the rate of American companies, good American companies leaving the country continues to accelerate at this rate, somehow it won't choke off American productivity. You'd have to say that if the rate of jobs leaving America continues to grow at the same rate, it won't somehow destroy American productivity and the American worker. You'd have to say that somehow the middle class has got to recover from its current lack of growth of its real earnings that it's experienced for the last 20 years, that somehow that's going to turn around. In other words, you've got to create a macro view of the world that says that tomorrow is going to be vastly different for America than it's been for the last two, three decades. And that's a hard case to make. The American people keep voting people into office whose job it is to control things. And that control has been pushed in as almost like octopus tentacles around the throats of young, small startup businesses, to a point where the founders of Home Depot, for example, said that they couldn't possibly start that company today. And you have to wonder how many Home Depots don't get started before American productivity gains stop happening. And we already know that today the only people who are getting richer in America are the one percenters. I mean, this is the basis of Bernie Sanders' entire candidacy. And it's all about crony capitalism, bigger government. Unfortunately, you know, as much as I love a lot of what Bernie says, and I do, his idea to fix it is bigger government. So I don't see a turnaround here, honest to God. Okay.
You don't see a turnaround?
No.
Let's say I do.
Okay.
Are you speculating? And am I speculating? We both have an opinion. We both have reasons for our opinion.
Yep.
Are we both speculating or are we both investing?
We're both speculating.
Because, so you're speculating as well.
Yeah, because the ideas are too big for me to absorb all of the possibilities. There are things out there that can happen I just can't account for. Now, where am I not speculating?
Right. If you have all of those views
on
the market as a whole, on the country as a whole.
Right.
How does that not bear on choosing a particular given company and buying that company?
Well, because what we're looking for in the future is greater productivity without really doing anything much different. All right. So I'm going to go back to our real estate example. Remember that building we had at NYU?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is a building that Warren Buffett found in like the 80s, I think?
90s.
In the 90s. Yeah. It was near NYU in New York somewhere.
Owned by the federal government, who had taken it over from a bank or a savings loan that went under.
And it had a tenant that was paying a really low rate that was locked into something like seven more years of a lease.
Nine more years in the building.
And there were a bunch of empty suites in the building. And basically, it was kind of a mess.
Well, it was a mess. It wasn't producing much income. And it was going to be a long time before it did produce a lot bigger income. But consider Buffett's criteria for that being an investment rather than a speculation. Okay. Number one, he wasn't buying the building in anticipation of being able to increase the rents to make the deal make sense. He bought the building with a 10% cash flow on the money that he paid for the entire building. So the first thing right off the bat is if nothing changes in America, nothing changes in New York, this thing is in a location that'll keep doing what it's doing, which means 10% per year, like a bond.
So if nothing changes, you expect it to make money.
It's making money, and it'll make money for the next 10 or 20 years. Okay. Just the way it is. Okay? So second thing is, without doing anything, in 9 years, three-quarters of the building comes vacant, and I can release it at market rents. Instead of getting $5 a foot, I'm going to get $70 a foot. Again, if nothing changes, I'm going to get $70 because that's today's rents. So I'm not looking for it to go up in the future and I'm going to get 100. All I care about is that the tenant leaves and I get to put somebody in there at standard market rent. All right. Those two things make this an investment. Now, a lot of people would buy that same real estate, but they would buy it with no cash flow in anticipation of this tenant leaving. And then the cash flow goes up and you make a good deal. So something wonderful has to happen here. With Buffett, nothing wonderful has to happen. All it has to do is just keep going. That's very different. That's why I'm calling this an equity bond, as a way of distinguishing the kind of company we're looking for from, you know, the one that you buy. Well, the venture capitalists are the extreme case where they're getting a company that doesn't even really exist, and they're just hoping these really smart people can come up with something eventually, which is vast speculation, not investing. No matter what they want to call it, because they're out raising money, we call it speculation to distinguish it from what we consider to be really real investing. And not to just blast away here, but geez, Charlie Munger has told us, you don't make money when you buy a company. You don't make money when you sell it. You make money when you wait, and you wait, and you wait in cash for these opportunities that come along. And Charlie and Morin have both said, if you just had a punch card with 20 punches in it, and that's all you got the rest of your life, you would take your time. You would wait to know, this is one of those really good ones. I've got to get it. And that's one punch because I've only got 19 left. Or now I've got 11 punches left. I got to be darn sure if I buy this company, it's really a great one. And so Charlie and Morin are both saying, anybody can do this. This isn't about having a high IQ. It's about being patient and knowing what a wonderful business looks like compared to all the other stuff that's out there. And I'm going to stipulate right here that a wonderful business is an equity bond situation.
Here's the problem, though. That's based on your opinion, your evaluation of this business or this building or whatever it is you're buying, that creates an opinion that you have about what's going to happen in the future. Now, you may be extremely certain of that opinion, such as with that particular real estate purchase. It sounds like he was extremely certain. It's not the same as certainty. He was extremely confident in his opinion.
Okay, I'll
now,
buy that.
If I'm extremely confident in my opinion that the market is going to go up and everything you just said about the U.S. economy is dead wrong and it's going to be the exact opposite of that, and we are going to have a 3x over market rise, what if I'm extremely confident in my opinion? Am I now an investor?
Oh my gosh, I think you got me. Oh,
I mean,
man.
This, I feel like
you
this
set
doesn't
that
even
up.
Matter,
I've been
and I don't
set
know
up.
Why we're talking about this.
I have been set up in court and knocked over like a bowling pin. That was unfair. You set that up knowing you were going to go there, didn't you?
I did not know we were going to discuss this today.
But you just set me up so that I was totally screwed
you
when I agreed to
I
that.
I can't help it when you're wrong. I just can't help it. The point is, you're using the term investing to mean low risk investing, and you're using the term speculation to mean high risk investing.
Yes.
That's what's that. I just want to be clear about that.
Okay. I will agree with you. And I'm perhaps being hyperbolic. Is that a word?
That is a
word.
I know
it's a word. I'm hyping the situation. I'm exaggerating. If I were to say that the, you know, buying the index is speculation. But honestly,
and the thing is, I think so you're right. Sometimes, like for a lot of people, it completely is speculation because they don't have any basis on which they're doing.
They have no basis at
all. Same for buying Coca-Cola. Frankly, yeah. They buy it because somebody told them it was a good stock, so they go buy it. Like that's also speculation.
So fair enough. It would be to the degree that a person feels highly confident that they know what they're doing, they've done the work, that this would change from speculation to investing. And so for me, you know, what I might consider an investment would be considered wild speculation by maybe Buffett. And maybe what I would consider wild speculation would be considered investing by a venture capital guy.
I don't know. It's a really, okay. So I just said that I don't even know why we're talking about this, but now I'm so glad we're talking about this because this is exactly something that I've been wrestling with my own feelings about putting money into a company and putting money into the market. It's terrifying. And I feel speculative about it because I don't have confidence in my opinion. Well, then even if I've done the research, I don't have confidence in my own research because I don't have much experience. I have almost no experience.
Right.
And I think a lot of people feel that way. So even when you've run the numbers and you've gone through the steps that Charlie tells you to go through, it's still at the end, you're looking at this sort of conclusion and you're going, Is there like an answer key somewhere? Because I could have done this completely wrong and I will not know until I've lost half of my portfolio, which is terrifying.
I got you 100%. Well, let me wrap up by saying a couple of things about that. First, okay.
Something we're going to talk more about because fascinated by it.
Oh, yeah. This is deep stuff. And this is right where the rubber meets the road for most novice investors is what Danielle, you're talking about right now is huge. And so what we try to do is to narrow down the world of, oh my God, I don't know anything, to a small number of companies that fit into what we call the canyon or what Warren Buffett calls the circle of competence. And we try to understand what we know and be pretty clear about what we don't know and stay away from what we don't know. So initially, if you start off, not knowing anything at all, then we got to keep narrowing things down until we get into a couple of companies where, while you might not know anything, at least you know you like what they do because you're a customer.
Yeah.
All right. So that's where we want to start. I'll leave it at that for right now. We want to start right there where you're already a customer. You're a consumer of the thing those guys do, which means you've already had some discernment in there. Presumably,
yeah,
it's competitive.
I mean, to bring it back to Chipotle, that's a classic example. Good food. We like how they handle their ethics. We know that they're going to clean up their, at least we know that they're going to do their best to clean up this E. coli situation.
Yep.
And generally think it's managed well. So
well, next
that's
time,
a company. And I have done no research on Chipotle. So I know that from, you know, eating in their restaurant once a week for the last
being in the world.
5 years.
Okay, so let's do this next time. Let's talk about how we would figure out how to come to a value on Chipotle, looking at it, whether it's an investment, whether we can get it to an investment status, or it has to stay speculative because we just don't know. So let's use that as the main criteria. At what point does this flip from being a roll of the dice, plural, into something that's more like a bond with that level of kind of certainty to it? Let's dive into that because I think that's really, really getting to where the rubber meets the road for you in particular.
I agree. Okay. Good plan.
All right. Well, until next time.
Thanks,
time to
everybody.
Go play. See ya.
Bye.
Bye. Hey, thanks for listening to Invested, the Rule One podcast. If you like this episode, you can always get our show notes and more details and links to the resources we discussed at investedpodcast.com. Also, as long as you're online, head on over to investedpodcast.com/workshop for details on an upcoming 3-day live workshop that I'm hosting. All you got to do is enter the special podcast code STOCKPILE, that's STOCKPILE, STOCKPILE, into the application form, and you guys can attend for free. So everything discussed on this show is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And it is not to be taken as investment advice because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only. And I really do hope you've enjoyed it. So until next week, it's time to go play. See ya.